This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
The Bob Dylan Center is a miracle. Actually, it's four miracles. Miracle number one is Bob Dylan. Anyone listening to this knows that there's no other explanation for the totality of who this guy is or what he has done. Without him, no Bob Dylan Center. Miracle number two. Bob Dylan saves every goddamn thing he ever touches or gets near for 50 years. Who does this? Who does this when you're constantly traveling around the globe, invested in thousands of events and enterprises with tens of thousands of people? Without this archive, no Bob Dylan Center. Miracle number three. An oil billionaire in Oklahoma decides to fund the acquisition of those archives, purchase and set up a building, hire staff, and operate a museum for a Jewish rock and roller from Malibu by way of New York, by way of Hibbing, Minnesota. Without George Kaiser, there's no Bob Dylan Center. Miracle number four. Everyone involved in this project, from Bob to Dylan's management to the staff hired to build and operate this, to the contracting teams who get line item responsibility, to guest stars of all kinds, all of whom do a world-class job of setting up and filling and operating the place. Without the teams of people who executed, there is no Bob Dylan Center. And without the actual folks who did this and still do, it could have gone wrong in 100 different ways. On May 10th, the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma celebrated its first anniversary. I was fortunate to be there when Michael Gray gave a wonderful talk sharing his experiences and thoughts on Bob Dylan, who he first saw live in one of those famous 1966 concerts. That talk, I believe, will soon be shared on video with all Dylan Center members. This was my first visit to the center, and I hope to share a very lengthy set of impressions in a blog post soon. All I'll say here is that I was blown away by how excellent it was, not just because it holds so much cool stuff, which it does, but because of how thoughtfully and well-executed everything was and is. The most amazing thing about Bob Dylan to me is the scale. He's bottomless in every direction, and somehow the center seems to realize that. They don't try to hold him or his story in on any sides, and both in terms of the physical space and the broader operations they're enabling. They support the exploration of Dylan, not in some small way as a musician or person or a cultural figure, but in all the big and unexpected ways that Dylan inspires. While in Tulsa, I was able to sit down with Steve Jenkins, the director of the Bob Dylan Center. I asked Steve if he would indulge me in a conversation where I asked the questions that might only matter to us Dylan freaks. I told him going in, I was going to ask, but of course he didn't have to answer anything, and that we could cut out or not use anything that wasn't appropriate or not comfortable for conversation. He not only agreed, but he answered everything and asked for no edits. As you'll hear today, Steve is knowledgeable, passionate about Dylan and the center, and genuinely interested in making the most of the opportunity he and we have with the Bob Dylan Center. Steve is definitely one of the miracles, the right guy in the right place at the right time, which makes the Dylan Center so powerful and exciting. Now, here's my conversation with Steve Jenkins, director of the Bob Dylan Center. Steve, well, thanks for agreeing to talk. As I said, what I'd like to do is talk about some of the things that the hardcore Dylan people might like to know about the Bob Dylan Center. We've all watched and listened and learned a lot in the last year or two, and everyone who's been here is incredibly impressed, as I now am, after I've walked through about half your facilities, and in 2 days, I don't think I could have taken it in any faster. There's just so much, and it's so good. We're here at the one-year anniversary, and Michael Gray spoke last night, which was fabulous. Why don't you give us a little bit of a state of the universe after a year from the point of view or talking to the people who have paid attention?
Sure thing. So first of all, a pleasure to be speaking with you in this context, especially on the auspicious occasion. We have made it to the 1 year, as you say. And, you know, it's just been full steam ahead from the first moment. So I'm not even sure if I've had a time or have been able to create the space to reflect on everything in its totality. I do know that, you know, the numbers tell a certain story. 40,000 plus people in during the first year. We've had visitors from all 50 states. I wasn't sure if Alaska was going to make it the first year, but sure enough, some folks from Anchorage were here. You know, I think we're in over 30 countries now represented by visitors, hardcore Dylanologists and also more casual fans, but a lot of people just feeling the sense that this was a pilgrimage that they had to make. To come and see the Dylan Archive, all of the materials that we have on display, and to feel connected, perhaps in an even more immediate way than they've been able to before, because we've got these materials, of course, from the archive, from Dylan himself, that I believe shed new light on the creative process. One thing we've really focused on for this whole first period, and as we're looking ahead to the next phase, is that concentration on creativity. And while that might sound obvious, since we have an entire center devoted to one particularly fearless creator, I think it's worth making that point. Sure, the biographical details are here, and you can learn about Dylan in a chronological way and walk through his life and work thus far. But what we're most concerned with, and what we've focused on, if we've done our job well, is that creative process and looking at Dylan as an exemplar of fearless creativity. Visitors really seem to be picking up on that. And, you know, I've heard time and again that they feel inspired to tap into their own creativity, which definitely is part of the mission. So it's been nice to see some of our big picture ideas sort of play out on a day-to-day level as visitors are coming through. They're very eager to share feedback. Once they walk in the doors, many of them are super excited. And whether it's 90 minutes later or 5 hours later or two or three afternoons later, they're eager to talk to staff. You know, oh, I can't believe I got to see the postcard from Pete Seeger. That explains so much more about what happened at Newport 65. Or, you know, I had no idea he did pastels, because sure enough, we have this whole beautiful suite of portraits that Dylan made in that medium. So a lot of surprises that visitors are encountering, and then a real desire to share and talk through. So it's communal in a sense. At the same time, everyone coming through, I think, finds their own path, their own journey. You know, I playfully refer to No Direction Home as a sort of ethos for us. We try to extend that throughout the galleries, two floors of exhibition space, with no one dictating or providing a constrained experience as to how one must go through the center.
It's not one of these places where you start in hallway A and it's almost a maze where you have to do it, and then you get let out in the street and
yes,
goodbye.
Like an IKEA store, I suppose. You know, in some museums, particularly those that rely on an audio guide and headset experience, usually for, you know, a temporary exhibition, not always for a permanent collection, but there's usually only one way to navigate those things, you know. Please stop here and listen to X, and then turn to your left and step three paces and check out the next, you know, old master painting, and here's what you must think about it. We're really trying to get away from that and just provide information, suggest context, suggest possibilities that the material seem to you know, bring up for us. But as always with listening to Dylan, just going through the Dylan Center, everyone's interpretation is equally valid and fascinatingly diverse, what people take away from the experience.
And for people who haven't been here, you've got a sort of nice tap system. You hand out a little iPod with headphones, and then people can wander around, and there's a like a tap pay kind of thing, but it's a tap listen.
Touch points, we call them. There are dozens throughout the galleries, and whatever catches your fancy, whether it's a photo of young Bob with his high school friends, and you see a touch point there, well, what's all that about? You know, it's a former buddy of his who formed a band in high school. And so we go that far back in Dylan's musical evolution. And, you know, so you can spend some moments there. Maybe across the way in that same gallery is an entire section on one song. Let's say Joker Man, for example. And you can listen in on early versions leading up to the a performance of the song on the Letterman show with, you know, the pickup band, the Plugs. Looking at 10 different iterations of the lyrics of the song in that same section. So in all these cases and many, many more, there are layers of information. We have found, again, you asked to, you know, where are we? What's the state of things now with year one, just in the rearview mirror? And it's that things are working well insofar as we've tried to design the center so that someone walking through who, you know, maybe has limited time or nose blowing in the wind and is mildly curious as to what happened after that, I think there's plenty for that visitor to see and to listen to. We call those skimmers, if you will, not pejoratively, just as a descriptor. Swimmers, the next level that we think about, I picture them doing laps back and forth in the gallery. They're checking things out. They want to be sure they haven't missed anything, or they're listening into something two or three times, or looking at all the video footage, going deep, deep, deep into these different levels and really getting as full experience as possible. But beyond those, and maybe the Dylanologists listening in today will relate most to the divers. So beyond the skimmers, beyond the swimmers, you have the folks doing the really deep dive. And if you want to get into all of the audio and video that's available through the tap of an audio guide, through the scrolling on a screen in the gallery space, you have all these opportunities to get into hours and hours and hours of, you know, rare footage. Most of this, again, that folks had never seen before the archives made their way to Tulsa, where we now have them in the permanent home.
So let's talk about that. When you have a limited amount of space, you have a limited amount of resources, and you have this giant treasure of things that I assume is actually still growing. I wanted to ask about that.
Sure.
So there's a natural thing from the insatiable in a bad way. You could lay this stuff out from here to Dallas and we'd go, yeah. Well, gee, can't you make it to Austin? what's the thinking on that? I mean, you provide an enormous amount, but there's more. And I was going to throw one of your predecessors' quotes at you. In 2017, Michael Chaykin stood on stage and said, if you want to come listen to, you know, every second of the Street Legal Sessions, you'll be able to walk in. If you want to come watch every frame of D.A. Pennebaker's footage, you'll be able to do that. Practical reality, I assume, took over there. But what's the short answer to the folks who go, you know, we want everything.
Yes.
You're supposed to give it to us, which you're not, but we can think that.
No, of course. You know, we don't want to hoard the material. The whole point is to make this as accessible and available as we possibly can. And that's on two levels. That's for the general public who are coming into the public exhibition space, which is about 15,000 square feet of our 29,000 square foot facility. The other layer is for scholars, academics, researchers who, if their application is properly vetted and if they have, you know, seemingly have a very good legitimate reason to do so, we will grant access to the bulk of the materials that we can't at any one time have out on the floor simply due to to lack of space. We'd be in the same boat if we were a 100,000 square foot facility, you know, because there's that much. So we have to be smart as curators and as organizers to tell the best stories we can tell with the materials available and with the space available. We also don't want to pack so much into the public space that it truly becomes an overwhelming experience.
Dylan creates this problem because it's so big, so wide,
yes.
And you can go deep as possible on every one thing. It really is a curation problem, and you've done it beautifully. I'm by no means here to complain, but I can see how hard that would be on anything.
Sure. Well, that, you know,
you could fill that whole lobby with, you know, blood on the track, the whole facility with blood on the tracks if you wanted. I'm
we
sure
we could, which I think would be of real interest to a subset of a subset. So that's part of the thinking too, which is how do we appeal to folks who are listening in today who no doubt know very possibly quite more than I do about take 36 versus take 47 of any given track. you know, we want the fun of that and the sort of obsessive, the wonderful obsessiveness of that. But again, I mentioned, say, the hypothetical visitor who, as of day one, was no longer hypothetical but was real, which is Dylan. Is he still alive? What, you know, what became of him? Imagine not knowing the answers to some of those fundamental questions, but we have to. And I say this not in any sort of condescending way. On the contrary, if we're to sustain ourselves, you know, for year after year after year, and we're not going anywhere, this is for good here in Tulsa, we must be of interest and appeal and value to really as wide an audience as possible. So when you think about it along those lines, while still being extraordinarily rigorous in our research, in our scholarship, in the decisions we're making about what to show and what not to show at any given time, you know, taking it very seriously, we have to put ourselves in the shoes of someone for whom Dylan is not a waking and a dream time obsession. That's why, for example, the 23-minute immersive film experience Multitudes is set up at the beginning of the visitor experience, so that someone can walk right in and really be hit with this multi-leveled, multi-projected, you know, audiovisual spectacle, if you will, to really pull folks right into the times, the places, the mindset even of Dylan at pivotal points throughout his life. Now, you know, we might want to see an 8-hour version of that, and we'd gladly sit there and have the images and the sound surround us on three sides of the gallery. But to do it in a succinct way, but still be visually rich and leave an ambiguity, being true to Dylan's spirit, a little fun mixing of fact and fiction, you know, playing into some of the mythology, but also questioning and challenging that self-mythology. All of that's in there, I think, in bits and pieces. But I've heard time and again from visitors that they were quite emotionally moved and are by that initial film experience. So again, diehards will look for one thing. Aha, finally, we get the Man in Me studio footage that was long rumored to have existed. Someone was in there with a camera. Amazing. You know, for another viewer, that's just a blip in a larger story that we're trying to tell.
Yeah, I think both in there, which I just did prior to us sitting down, and in the whole gallery, that the line between, well, what I would assume, the interest to casual people, I mean, I see the people walking around, and frankly, the fact that you can satisfy hardcore people at all, and I mean genuinely, and I've been here for the last few days with a bunch of very hardcore, Michael Gray, I walked around with a bunch, and you know, if you can impress and satiate, at least for a moment, the people who you clearly do, it's really an amazing accomplishment. I did want to talk about that thing, the gap or the gulf between the casual and the hardcore, mm-hmm. in terms of getting into understanding the economics, if you will, of the business a little bit. You know, when this was announced, it was obviously the Kaiser Foundation funded a lot. They put down a bunch of the money for the initial acquisition. My understanding was Dylan made a contribution, that a piece of the archives were bought and a piece was contributed. I don't know if you can clarify anything about that, but, and obviously this beautiful building was bought and revitalized and so forth. But there's also the clear impression from the outside that you guys have a mandate to operate as a business and you don't have an unlimited well of funds to go. So talk a little bit about what the goal is for the business and sort of how visitors, members, and donations and sponsors fit together to keep this thing running forever, because we all want it to run forever.
Sure thing. So you mentioned the Kaiser Foundation, and for listeners who might not be aware, George Kaiser is a lifelong Tulsan, and like many Tulsans of his era, he's in his 70s, you know, let's say was quite successful in the oil business. This is Oklahoma, and after the cattle industry sort of hit its heights and faded a bit from its apex, you know, oil and gas and the energy industry really took hold. And, you know, there are a number of people who were quite successful in those ventures, George Kaiser being one of them. Unlike most, he has turned around and put all of that back into Tulsa. He's a real philanthropic force and a source of inspiration and influence for a lot of other folks who have the capacity to make significant changes in their towns or elsewhere. You know, in his case, he's chosen to focus on Tulsa because he's lived here all his life. His great passion is early childhood education and introducing programs over the last several decades that have really moved the needle on levels of success, accessibility, you know, trajectory professionally and personally for students and youngsters who are from, you know, historically underserved communities here in Tulsa. And that's where a tremendous amount of success of that foundation has come in. Mr. Kaiser is equally interested in what we would call civic enhancement. You know, that's the building of a 65-acre park called the Gathering Place. That's the acquisition of the Woody Guthrie Archive. 10 years ago, we just hit the 10-year anniversary this past weekend, days before the 1 year of Dylan, and then the acquisition of the Dylan Archive. So, look, we're absolutely blessed and honored to be working with the Kaiser Foundation, who indeed made this endeavor possible. I not to skirt the question of, you know, what was the arrangement made with Dylan in his camp. This did happen before I arrived on the scene. I've read the same newspaper articles that everyone else has. Various amounts have been bandied about. And if I could tell you, give you an exact dollar amount, I would. I honestly don't know. I just know that both sides were pleased with how the negotiations went. And Dylan, for all sorts of reasons, and we could get into this.
And just to be clear, I didn't care what the purient aspect of it. I just thought it was actually clever. It was another feather in Jeff Rosen's cap that the innovation to, you buy some set of value,
yes,
I'll donate the rest, yeah, which gives me a lovely tax write-off, and the end result is good for everybody.
It's good for everybody, and that it's something like that might well have worked out, but I can't give you a firsthand account of those discussions. So anyway, that's a bit about Kaiser. So yes, our main supporter is the George Kaiser Family Foundation, but it is imperative that we as a nonprofit arts organization, just like all others, have a very diverse revenue stream. It's never a good idea, even if it's, you know, the best philanthropist in town, to rely on any one source, because things change, priorities change. We've all seen it happen at different nonprofits. So we are looking for a broad base of supporters, and we've been building that even leading up to the opening of the center. Of course, there was a very successful capital campaign. And since then, and this is through all the usual means, individual donors, a vibrant membership program with a lot of different levels. You can enter in for a base price of $60, and it goes up and up from there with different benefits that are made available. We have an annual giving program, foundation grants, corporate sponsorship. You know, none of these are... We see valuable partnerships in all of these categories. We've not yet delved into government grants, but that's something that I'm interested in. We've had some exploratory conversations, for example, with folks at the National Endowment for the Arts who say, absolutely, you should be applying. You know, this is sort of instantly, overnight, practically an institution that we'd be very interested in looking at. So there are a lot of possibilities there down the line. We have a full development team here who's... primary responsibility, of course, is fundraising. And we're making friends, and just, you know, there are Dylan enthusiasts from all walks of life. And we're just delighted that so far so many people have wanted to partner with us.
So let's talk about the membership a little bit. So when it was first announced, I don't remember how far ahead of the opening it was. As you say, there's kind of a bunch of really accessible levels, kind of 60, whatever, up through 1,000, 2,500. And then there's some higher end levels where people can make more substantial contributions. How do you think about the future evolution of that membership program? I mean, my sense of it as a user was people would join at the level that was economically, you know, accessible to them. And it was half, hey, I want to help, and half, I'm certainly going to go. And so I want to be able to walk in. But I know you're evolving the benefits. I know the newsletter started to pick up, and, yes, you know, you've got a lot of things planned. So how do you see the membership, the activity level and the interaction level of membership changing over the next year or two? And it's totally understandable that your plate was more than full for the last year, and we're all happy you did what you did. I'm just curious how you see that membership and interaction going forward.
Yes. Well, we've, you know, in recent months, we've ramped up the level of activity. And I think that might be what you're referring to. You know, the much of the first year was simply getting the doors open, figuring out all of our daily operations. How does this 100-year-old paper factory work as essentially now a museum? And there's interesting challenges that come along with that.
Is there a swear jar around here you have to use if you use the word museum?
No, there's not. We'll throw it in every once in a while. But we do use center very pointedly. You're right. You know, we've had our hands full. Look, there's a small but dedicated crew here. All of our staff, my amazing colleagues, we're all still wearing numerous hats. And this is not uncommon for nonprofits, you know, where, you know, I'm director, which could mean on any given day that I'm calling the HVAC vendor because it's, you know, a little too chilly in the downstairs gallery, to meeting with a donor, to sitting for an interview, whatever it might be, you know, just really runs the gamut.
Steve, we see those pictures of you walking around here with Elvis Costello, so no one's going to feel bad about
No, and I'm certainly not complaining that part of the job happens to be, you know, well, Jenkins, we'd like you to be the public face, which means that when Elvis walks in, you can do the meet and greet. There have been, you know, more surreal moments in this first year than my 10-year-old self, or now my 56-year-old self, can still quite wrap my head around. You know, hanging out with Henry Rollins for a day and talking Dylan is not a bad Thursday afternoon. Behind all of that is, you know, is everything ready to open tomorrow morning? And is everyone in place? And do we have the resources we need? And all the rest of it. But, you know, look, when you're talking the mission that we're talking and the material that we're surrounded by, all of it is exciting. It's overwhelming, sure. And I never pretend that it's not, as my to-do list just continues to grow. But this is no different than anyone else working a nonprofit job at any level, you know, from membership coordinator to director to, you know, tech lead to whatever it might be. We all play really vital roles. And the key is to create a positive, dare I say, profound experience for visitors. Now, many of the visitors are members, getting back to that, and we want to increase that membership. We think that a way to do so is to just have a lot of offerings to put in front of folks, not merely on the walls of the galleries, but in real time with events such as the one you referenced that we had last night with one of the foremost Dylan scholars, Michael Gray, who came out here from the south of France to give a presentation last night. So I think there will be those sort of only at the Dylan Center type experiences that we can provide that members are very eager to take part in. What we hear most from everyone is access. Give me access. What's behind the scenes? Who are the experts? You know, we really want to talk Dylan. We want to learn more than we already know. Let's get the smartest people around to come to Tulsa and share their perspective and their experience with us. So we're expanding on the number of public programs. We also have a concert series with a partner organization here called Lowdown, which is a really lovely intimate jazz club that's a basement level down the stairs sort of scene that feels right for Dylan and analogous artists. This Friday night, for example, the great Mark Eitzel, who fronted the amazing American Music Club out of San Francisco and to me is one of truly our great singer-songwriters. He'll be performing in a club that seats 100 people. Robin Hitchcock will do the same in June. So these are experiences that I think we can offer to members that hopefully keep them renewing. And so that they feel, yes, they're doing something to support the cause, but they're rewarded with that experience is taking place here on the ground in Tulsa at the center and nearby. We have members around the world though as well. And so we're very concerned with making sure that they feel like they're along for the fun too. So we're doing more live streaming. We're making content available, say through an exclusive members only newsletter, clips on social media, that sort of thing.
And that's a challenge, right? Because you want to be a physical space and you want to bring people here, but there's reality that here is Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Absolutely.
Lovely as it is, it's not the most convenient place in the world.
Direct flight from New York now, and more cities being added. But yes, we know it can be a trek to get out here. So we're so appreciative for all these visitors who've made the effort the first year. We'll do our best to, you know, to bridge those gaps by delivering, I think, some really exciting content, electronically until people can make the trip themselves.
There's trade-offs is how you're thinking about that I'm interested in. And the trip is clearly worth it, right? I'm in the middle. And as I've told you privately, I did 2 hours downstairs the first day. And I could not have walked up the stairs because I couldn't take any more in. Mm-hmm. And by no means do I think I was exhaustive even on floor one. So everyone should definitely come. But the practicality is, even if, you know, someone can get here once a year, once every 2 years,
yes,
that's a different thing. How are you thinking about those trade-offs, right? There's nothing stopping a lot of stuff from going online except that it's not the same, and it devalues certain things. And, you know, there's no easy answer, so I'm not trying to play gotcha. I'm just curious.
Sure.
I know you've recorded these things, and you're now going to make them available to members, and I think that's great. Tell us how you're wrestling with it.
Yeah, we're continuing to think about that. You know, again, going back to this idea that, you know, what good is an archive if it's sitting on the proverbial dusty shelves and, you know, and no one's seeing it except for, you know, a couple people on staff who open up those boxes and put on the white gloves. Or funnily enough, no longer put on the white gloves for a lot of the materials because they're found to potentially be more damaging than the skin of our potentially oily fingertips. But if you wash up well, you actually can touch a lot of things now without a layer of latex. So we want to make this stuff available at the same time, at least in this initial phase. Getting people to Tulsa has been a big part of the mission. We're hoping that visitors are discovering not only the treasure trove of the Dillon Center and our Woody Guthrie Center, but other attractions in Tulsa too. So that has been a thrust, but we inevitably will figure out ways to put more of the materials online. If we think it does both the materials and the viewers justice, you know, we don't want a poor reproduction of the Blood Notebooks, for example, circulating, and then gets off on a trajectory of its own and maybe can be misinterpreted, or the objects aren't being seen really for what they are. So we're thinking a lot about that. Could we potentially take the show on the road? What might that look like? Could we have an exhibition from the Dillon Center going to world capitals all over, or to Hibbing, or to you name it?
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah. So that's something that we're trying to wrap our minds around as we think about long-term exhibition schedules, not only here in the galleries, but potentially at venues internationally. So that's something to consider.
Well, you threw me with that one. I had a question, and now I got so excited about that, I forgot. Uh-huh. I forgot what it was. So one little piece of that has already been announced, and hopefully I'm going to get to chat with the man in charge of that a little bit, is you're putting out a book, which was a surprise to me.
Yes.
And the contents are extremely exciting. So maybe just a little mention of that, and I'll talk deeper to Mark about it.
Sure thing. Mixing Up the Medicine, the official release went out just earlier today. Amazon got on it before anyone through our publishing partner, Callaway of New York, who listeners might know, they've done so many beautiful books over the years, very high-end art books, exhibition catalogs, and they did the Get Back book, which was a compendium that accompanied Peter Jackson's series on the Let It Be sessions. And so we thought, well, they'll certainly understand this material and treat it sympathetically and put it in its best light. So this has been a long gestating project that my amazingly astute and dedicated colleague, Mark Davidson, who is our director of archives and exhibitions, has really seen through from the very beginning and has taken an enormous amount of time and energy to produce what's ultimately a 600 plus page look into the archive. So, you know, in answer to the earlier question, this is one significant way in which we will be sharing these materials in a way that we feel we can really do justice to, because this will be of very high print quality and really be a handsome volume that I think all, you know, Dillon fans will want to put on their shelves alongside all the other wonderful Dillon books. It's a story of the archive. how the materials came here and what's there, what's in the treasure trove. And part of how we're looking at that is we invited about 30 writers, artists, musicians, multi-hyphenate thinkers to take one item in the archive and just go for it and think through the meanings and the implications and the potentials of that one object from their own perspective. So we have Michael Ondaatje, for example, novelist who might be best known for The English Patient, Amanda Petrusich and Alex Ross, you know, two of the, among that incredible cadre at The New Yorker, who write so incisively and movingly and accessibly about music of all sorts. We have the great Richard Hell, and the list goes on and on. Joy Harjo, who is our artist in residence here, who's written a beautiful essay called Tangled about her love of the song Tangled Up in Blue and how it's intersected with her personal history as a member of Muskogee Nation and much more. So just a little, that's, you know, a few tantalizing hints as to what's in there, but it's like the center. And like Dylan himself, the book aims to be multifaceted, multidimensional. You know, I contain multitudes, says Dylan, quoting Walt Whitman as Rough and Rowdy Ways kicks off. And I think this book does too. You know, over the hundreds of pages, the thousand plus images that do reproduce some of the items in the archive. So I suppose, yes, I buried the lead in a way earlier, but this will be in many ways the next best thing to seeing much of the archival material in person. And this will be out in October 24th.
Another question I had about the archives logistically, how are things still coming in? Meaning, does Bob have a spring cleaning date on his calendar every year? And you go, okay, this is what I've thrown in the pile this year. And in terms of the ephemera, and then are the Rough and Rowdy Ways recording sessions here yet? And just generally, how does things update? And obviously this gets into the ongoing relationship with the Dylan camp.
Sure. And with other collectors as well, which I can talk about. So to recap just briefly, the collection was acquired in 2016 when everyone came to the agreement and boxes started arriving and, you know, you open up one after another and it's just these jaw-dropping moments of what's actually here. There was indication before some sort of inventory, but of course, Dylan and his folks, you know, they'd been keeping things in desk drawers and cardboard boxes. And so things weren't in archival order. You know, that's a whole other level of cataloging that you have to do. So that took a couple of years alone just to make sure we knew what we had, that everything was properly labeled, cataloged, put into a system called StarChive, which a lot of archivists use. And yes, you know, the understanding at that time was, well, and, you know, as we continue to go through, we might find some other things. There's an office that's, you know, needs a going through and we'll just get you everything that we have now. But stay tuned, you know, there could be some more surprises. And so, of course, that relationship with the Dylan camp has continued since 2016. Has been enormously supportive of our endeavors here. Hasn't really put up any barriers to ideas we've had about how to show the work or you know, real rotating exhibitions we've wanted to do or anything like that. So, you know, word comes through every now and again, we've found some stuff. You know, no one looked at the top shelf of a closet in the back of the corridor or whatever it might be. And so there's more to come. Specifically, you asked about the Rough and Rowdy Ways tour. Obviously, it's been ongoing. These have been revelatory shows. We will see if that material finds its way here.
Are the recording sessions or Shadow Kingdom even, but just generically, forget about the specific.
Yes.
Something like that happens. You know, we know Bob went for 30 plus days mid-pandemic, it seems, and made what became Shadow Kingdom.
Yes.
A, is there a deal? Is it like, hey, those get here and the timing is what needs to be determined? Or is it a separate set of decisions that they get to make at their own desire?
There's an understanding built into the initial deal or agreement or negotiation, whatever you want to refer to it as, that yes, other materials will be forthcoming as they are produced. So, you know, some of it's just a waiting game of when that material is ready to be shipped over. What condition are things in? Are we ready on the receiving end, you know, to properly house the material?
Do they want a buffer, like, okay, things like that even aren't available in the archives to researchers for 5 years or 2 years. So it's not too like, hey, you know, the album came out in May and in December, people are going through the outtakes.
I don't know if that's the concern so much. It's just the logistics of figuring out, you know, it sounds simple enough. We'll just box things up and ship them over. But it's, you know, we're talking, look, you know, these are priceless objects, right? And you have to do it the right way. Things need to rest. You know, that's an actual term in the world of archiving. You can't have things exposed to light or excessive movement. So just putting something on the back of a U-Haul isn't always the best way to go. So they're just very practical concerns that we have to think about. There might be other implications, such as you suggest, for, you know, maybe letting things sit for a longer period before they get dissected. You know, there's some fun in that mystery too, I think.
But since the 2016-17 initial batch, which I know even that took a while to come.
Yes.
More has arrived. There is a flow.
More has been identified, and there's a process in place. And I don't mean to sound cagey, but you know, I fear misspeaking because I don't have in front of me, say, an inventory of, okay, you know, on June 15th we're receiving the following. But there, suffice it to say, more will arrive. Now, in the meantime, when that announcement was made in 2016, that sure enough, there's something now called the Bob Dylan Archive, and sure enough, it's going to live on in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The phone starts to ring with, you know, folks with very interesting offers of donations, or perhaps they're looking to sell something. Hey, you've got the Dylan stuff. You know, my uncle met him somewhere along the way, you know, at a diner in Denver, and he posed for some photos, and we've always kept those in a photo album, and they're sitting, you know, maybe you want those, you know, so there's a lot of that sort of thing. And we just have to really look at that on a case-by-case basis. If this is a keepsake that means the world to its current owner, and it won't drastically alter our understanding of Dylan as a figure in the way that we're hoping to represent him, I would encourage folks to hang on to their ticket stubs, you know, because we might have other materials that are able to tell that same story. If there's something really that fills in a gap that we've identified, oh, if only we had such and such, we could do a whole other thing on Shot of Love. I don't know. I'm just making that up for now, or whatever it might be. Then sure, that might really be of interest. An issue of a magazine that contained an early Dylan interview. And oh, we're missing issue 8 of the run of 16. Boy, would we love just to complete the collection. You know, those sorts of things we would jump at if we can in the moment. But we're looking at it on a case-by-case basis.
Is there an acquisitions program? Things go up for sale. There's been notable auctions at Sotheby's and, you know, R&R and some other auction houses. And in the Dylan community, it's like, hey, that needs to be, you know, those little photos that just, when it, you know, happened, there was a bunch of photos.
Yes.
And the letters that went to Italy, apparently, from, you know, Bob's writing. Yes. And stuff, which seem like they belong here. And you have a cadre of defenders out here who think this is the natural home of everything. So are you guys, do you have a budget? Are you in the market? Is it part of the storytelling narrative you just talked about? Or how are you thinking about those things?
It is. And we look at, you know, we're as aware of those opportunities as we can be. We're not intending to sort of gobble up every last thing that exists out there. The letters, for example, these, you know, the sort of love letters from high school, which now are in a, you know, they ended up in a, they're going to be shown in a bookstore in Portugal, if I'm remembering correctly. That to us felt like Dylan himself wouldn't necessarily be comfortable with us showing that work. And although we don't know that factually, it's not like we got a call saying, hey, don't go after the letters. We just had a sense that that was less important to, again, the multi faceted picture of Dylan that we're trying to present than something else, a rare recording or
What about the photo, the little signed photo booth photos that were, I think, at the same auction? I don't think they came from the same source.
Yes.
That were, you know, I think timing wise and unique and certainly aesthetically incredible.
I suppose I'd characterize that as a nice to have, not a need to have. And again, we're in our first year of, second year of operations. We're in a comfortable spot. We do not have limitless resources to go after things. And, it's interesting to see in whose hands these objects are, in what collection these artifacts end up. And perhaps those might be folks that we have relationships with. Maybe they ultimately find their way here. But there's so much in our midst already that we just want to be sure to do justice to as we're, entrusted with stewarding this collection. That
so there's a budget. I mean, it was more the process than the specific I was curious about. So there's a budget. There's people who make the decision and think about it. And if it really belonged here, at least an effort, would be made, it sounds like.
Precisely. But we're not at Christie's if something goes up for auction automatically, and we're going to do anything we can to outbid.
So the Ionic recording didn't wind up here? T-Bones?
It did not. We followed that story with great interest. We love T-Bone. We thought that was absolutely fascinating. We can't wait to see if other recordings emerge. But that wasn't something that we were going to, we just simply wouldn't have had the resource to do that. And if we did, there's so much else we can do with that type of funding that can enhance the experience for thousands of visitors, more so than any one object could.
Well, Steve, thanks. This was perfect. Thanks for indulging my fan
intensity
here. You've just doing an amazing job, as I've been telling you for 2 days on behalf of those of us who love Bob and are almost can't believe this place exists.
I can't believe it most days, and I get to walk in all the time. And I'll tell you, I mean, just it. It will never be something that any of us here take for granted. The alarm goes off and you wake up and say, is it Monday again? Well, yeah, for 5 seconds, but then it's another Monday and I get to go, steep myself in this material for this, figure that I've just charted the course of my life since I was a kid. It's a pretty special position to be in. And I think I speak for everyone here on staff, our members, our supporters. It's just that enthusiasm, that sheer love for what this artist and his work has meant for us and continues to mean for us. If we can do right by that, then, it's just all worth it. It's a pretty terrific endeavor so far.
And the fact that you guys are all, true, deep fans, which, there's a lot of versions of this that would have come out bureaucratic or academic or whatever it is. And the combination of, as I've been fortunate enough to meet a bunch of you, the genuine passion and the depth, as well as the professionalism and the, I was thinking this morning, sort of reflecting on 2 days, and there's kind of nothing here that you go, I wish it, everything is done as good as you can imagine. And it's just shocking for anything these days, to be honest. But anyway, the combination of the right people, yet professional, it's not just a bunch of fans fuddling their way through. All of you have the right, backgrounds and credentials for what you're doing. So once again, in the Bob world, things get done the right way, as it seems like it always does. Anyway, thanks and congratulations.
Well, thank you for that. That's really nice to hear. Coming from a fellow insider, if we've passed the test for you, Craig, and for your listeners by extension, and I hope if you all haven't been able to come in, that you will be able to soon, that's high praise. So thanks. We're going to continue to build on this foundation of the first year. There's so much we're excited about. Exhibitions, programs, things which, we started months ago and maybe they'll come to fruition 6 months from now. It's a long game, and some of the really exciting stuff takes a long time to get right. But I think we've got some pretty special stuff coming up.
Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening.